The second chapter of the book of James begins with James outlining an example of playing favorites and warning us that we are not to play favorites. The example he gives is of the rich and poor members of that congregation, that if we show deference to those who are wealthy or of higher social standing and push those who are of lower social standing or of not great means aside, he equates it with committing adultery or murder. If you violate any one of the commands, you violated them all, he says. What is the commandment that we are to follow? It comes just before the reading you heard from the lectionary. He says, you then would do well to complete the royal rule of the Scriptures. What is the royal rule of the Scriptures? Love your neighbor as yourself. He got that from his Bible, the same place Jesus got it, from the Hebrew Bible. To love your neighbor as yourself, which I assume means that we're not simply talking about wealthy and poor or people of high standing, people of low standing within a society. We are talking about black folks and white folks. We're talking about immigrants and native born. We're talking about gay and straight. This applied to his particular setting at his particular time. And now we apply it to our particular setting at our particular time. Because you see, as he sums it all up, we can have all the faith in the world, but if that isn't lived out in acts of mercy, then what kind of faith is it? What is it worth? Mercy trumps judgment. If you show no mercy, he argues, you will receive no mercy. If you show mercy, then and only then will you receive mercy. In a little while, we'll be saying the Lord's Prayer as part of our communion service, and in essence, he's paraphrasing that part of the prayer that says, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. That's what it means. We say trespasses, we say debts. We're talking about sins. A while back, one of the pastors at Belmont United Methodist Church, Pam Hawkins, you may have heard about this on the news, read about it in the papers, did a service for two of her parishioners who happened to be of the same gender. Because of our rules within the United Methodist Church, she was brought up on charges. There was what we call in our discipline a just resolution. She was suspended for 90 days without pay, suspended from her ministerial duties. As a part of that just resolution, the district superintendent will have hearings at various churches to hear the pain of those of our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters who have been rejected by church and hurt by church. One of those hearings will be here, as a matter of fact, on October 4th. A short while ago, there was a gathering of clergy for inclusion here at West End. And there were presented petitions from Belmont United Methodist to change the language in our discipline. And the effect of the change of this language would be to truly treat our LGBT brothers and sisters as people of sacred worth, which means that it would change the fact that we now do not ordain gay and lesbian people. It would change the fact that now United Methodist clergy cannot do certain part of wedding services for same-sex couples. And those services cannot take place in our churches, which I have been told means on our property. I'm going to recommend that we make these available to West End members who would support that to sign on with Belmont in order for these petitions to be sent to General Conference next April in the hope that that language could change. Now, I know not everybody agrees with me on this. You don't have to agree with me. I bet over the past 5.5 years, there might have been even one or two things that you haven't agreed with me on, huh? That's okay. But as your pastor, I feel obliged to give you the best I have and the best I know. And that's what I'm going to try to do today. Because I'm going to recommend to Ministry Table that we make these petitions available for us to be supportive of those changes, those of us who choose to. I have four reasons, really. The first are kind of heady. The first one is very heady. And that is that we have two sacraments in the United Methodist Church. We have baptism and we have Holy Communion. And we do not restrict anyone from taking part in those. Most of our baptisms happen when people are too young for us to know what their sexual orientation is going to be, or pretty much anything else. They are loved before they even know it, purely and simply because they are children of God, people of sacred worth. When we invite folks to the table a little bit later, Erin will invite you to the table. She won't say, okay, anyone who's straight here can come, but if you're gay, you can't come. No, we welcome all to this table. Following the example of Jesus, we welcome all. It's interesting to me, however, and doesn't really make sense, that while we do not restrict the two rituals that we consider to be sacraments, we do restrict two rituals that we do not consider to be sacraments, ordination and marriage. That to me makes no sense at all. You would think the sacrament would be more restrictive than the non-sacrament, but that's not the way we have seen it in the past. Reason number two. Did you know that our Board of Discipleship cannot produce resources to help LGBT youth deal with their sexuality or their faith or anything else because of the language of our discipline? Money cannot be spent to help young people who are struggling, whose suicide rate is much higher than the general population, because of the restrictive language in our own discipline. Are we not called to minister to all people? That doesn't make sense to me. Reason number three. The Sunday morning after the Supreme Court decision making same-sex marriage available to all states, I received an email from a church member, and I have permission to tell this story. That church member began the email, "I understand that you cannot conduct the service, but can you refer me to someone who can, because this individual and his longtime partner were getting married?" I got back and I said, "Well, actually, there are parts of the service I can do without that being a chargeable offense. I can say a prayer. I can tell a story or preach a homily. I can read scripture. If the time works out, and if you want that, I'm willing to do that. But I can also refer you to someone who can do the whole service." A little later in the day, however, this individual got back and said, "Could we have the service in the chapel?" And I knew the answer. Because of the wording of the discipline, the answer was no. I just didn't want to give that answer. That afternoon, I talked with my district superintendent. She was very sympathetic, but she can't change the rules any more than I can. So late that night, I got back to say, if it were up to me, that would be fine, but our rules don't allow for that. Not the local church's rules, but the rules of the general church do not allow for that. Now, over the past 40 years, I have done hundreds of weddings. I have done weddings for people I knew would never darken the church door again. I have done weddings for people who had never darkened the church door before. I had done weddings for people who were on the rolls because their parents had been or their grandparents had been. I had done weddings for people I hoped would find a way into the congregation who did not. And this individual is someone who is here at worship every week, who serves the church in a variety of ways, significant ways, who serves on committees, who helped us raise $4.7 million last year to care for this building, and I had to say, no, you cannot have your service in this building. And then Nancy and I, when a child is baptized, one of us will stand over here and we will ask those parents, will you resist evil, injustice, and oppression in whatever forms they present themselves? And that convicts me. Would you not consider that an injustice? If it were to be applied to you or your child or your brother or sister, would you not consider that to be an injustice? And yet I promise to resist that. The only problem is, you see, the state cannot require me to violate my conscience or my theological understanding. They can't require me to do that. I don't care what a bunch of legislators say, they can't do that. But my church does it regularly. My church requires me to violate my personal convictions, my conscience, and my theological understanding. And who we say we are as a congregation. It starts getting personal at that point, doesn't it? Finally, and this is very personal for me. Some of you know this, others of you won't. As a young man, I married and then divorced. Later, of course, you know, I married Margaret. We have children. If I had been divorced at a different time in the life of the Methodist Church, I would have had to surrender my orders on the spot. I would no longer be a pastor. In fact, I would have had to surrender my membership. Think of that, those of you who are divorced. Think of that, those of you who have parents or children or brothers or sisters who are divorced. I would have had to relinquish my membership. Because you see, Jesus says a whole lot about divorce. He doesn't say anything about homosexuality. He says a whole lot about divorce, and you know what? It's pretty harsh. Thank God I experienced mercy. I experienced the mercy of God. I experienced the mercy of my district superintendent. I experienced the mercy of my bishop. I experienced the mercy of the congregation I was serving at the time, who surrounded me and my former spouse with great love and support. I was shown that kind of mercy. How can I withhold mercy from anyone else? I was given a second chance. And what came out of that second chance? Well, I would not have had Margaret. I would not have had Sarah. I would not have had Elizabeth. And I would not have had you. Because you see, I would have had to surrender my orders, and there would have been no possibility that I would ever serve this congregation. Now, for some of you, that would have been a great blessing for you. But you have been a great blessing for me, and I would have missed that had my church not shown mercy to me. So how can I, in turn, not extend mercy to others? You heard what James said. Those who show no mercy will receive no mercy. Ow! I don't know about you, but when I stand at the throne of grace, I'm going to be throwing myself on the mercy of the court. Because I'm going to need all the mercy I can get. But how about us who do show mercy? If we say we have faith but do not have works, what good is our faith, James says. If we play favorites with one group and shun another, it's like committing adultery or murder, James says. And if we don't show mercy, well, you heard it already. So that's why I'm recommending that ministry table make available to those who wish to sign the petitions from Belmont United Methodist Church to change the language in our discipline, to be consistent with the statement we make there that all people are of sacred worth. All people, no exception, are of sacred worth. I know some of you won't agree with that. That's okay. But I felt like as family, I needed to let you know why I'm making that choice. And after all, we are all family. All of us.